Welcome to episode 90 of The Hard Truth About B2B E-Commerce. I'm your co-host, Isaiah Ballinger, and I'm back with Tim on a at least relatively sunny day for me. I don't know about you guys, but it's like finally not dark outside, but
it's beautiful, actually. I mean, it's a little cool, but it's beautiful for recording in February. I'm pretty amazed. And so, hey, everyone, Timothy Peterson back. I'm so happy to be here. I want to just make sure that we do continue our tradition of giving some shout outs to listeners and viewers of our podcast. So I have a short list of folks I'm going to run through. So we have people, they run the gamut, all these different kinds of businesses, somebody from a microchip manufacturer, someone from an auction house, people just doing a whole variety, somebody who does 3D graphic imaging, people do all different kinds of things. So just want to give them a shout out. We got Meedy Hayden. We've got Annette Schwer, Amy Wexler, Carrie Leibowitz. And then we've got Parker Grant and Steve Jordan. These folks are all folks who are dedicated. They've called out different things from different episodes. I'm always seeking out these folks. So if anyone's listening and wants to just drop a hello and tell us that you are, in fact, listening and tell us what you like, just do that, and I'll see if I can give you a shout out in the future.
Or give us advice, right? We're still, we're always looking to improve and get more better content.
You know, the good thing is that nobody's contacting me saying we're horrible. So that's actually really
It's unlikely really they're going to do that though. If they,
I guess reach out if you think we're that bad, but I don't. I hope we're not. Right. So let me just pause for one moment to allow an insert for our sponsor mentions, and then I'm going to throw it back to Isaiah to introduce our guest.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to give you a word from our sponsors. Our first sponsor is Balance. Balance is a B2B e-commerce payment solution that works well for you and for your buyers. It offers a seamless one-click checkout for almost any payment method, including ACH, wire, checks, cards, even terms. It's used by leaders in B2B e-commerce, and it's as easy as buying a shirt from Amazon. Check them out at getbalance.com. Book a session and tell them what your needs are. They are the first dedicated payment platform for B2B e-commerce, 100% tailored to your needs. Thanks again to our sponsor, Balance. Our next sponsor is TradeCentric. TradeCentric transforms the way businesses transact by enabling punch-out, purchase order, and invoice automation solutions for over 3,000 companies around the world. Uniquely positioned at the intersection of e-commerce and e-procurement, TradeCentric helps B2B buyers connect with suppliers and automate payment, procurement processes to drive greater efficiency and user adoption of streamlined systems. Learn more at TradeCentric.com. Thank you to our sponsors. Okay, everyone, I hope that was enough time to get our mentions in there. Thank you once again to our sponsors. Isaiah, who do we have today on episode 9?
Yeah, no, I'm excited to, this is long overdue. Carlos Camacho is the associate director of e-commerce at Boston Scientific. We've been in touch mostly through LinkedIn for years now, just because it's such a small group of people that I think focus on B2B e-commerce. So kind of find each other really quickly if you're on LinkedIn, since there's not too many of us. And I know, previously for compliance reasons, it was kind of hard to get you on, but now we finally got you. So, thanks for finally making it. So.
Thank you definitely for the invite. Been watching your company grow over the years, and I enjoy reading your posts on LinkedIn as well as Twitter. You always have a lot of insightful things to say.
Thank you. Yeah. So you've pretty much been in e-commerce most of your career. I mean, I think you go back pre-e-commerce, but... talk us through kind of that trajectory so people kind of understand.
Yeah, So I think the whole thing was came about from initially working in retail many years ago before I entered college. And when you think about retail, there's a lot of things we can learn in retail that you can bring over to the world of e-commerce, like merchandising and thinking about cross sells and thinking about optimizing the flow through your checkout, right? Learned a lot of, you know, the business side, or, you know, how to conduct commerce through retail. Eventually I ended up in Japan, and I was living there for about 14 years. I was doing a lot of marketing there, marketing research. Eventually the internet caught on. That's how dating myself now. You know, internet caught on and started getting into web design, digital design. Eventually came back to the States and thought, okay, what do I do with myself? Landed at a company that was a traditional catalog company. So, you know, every month they would produce a 2-inch thick catalog with the prices and the products, and send that across to their customers. Very expensive, right? And by the time you've printed it, probably the prices were no longer valid. And so they were trying to remake themselves into e-commerce. And I worked there for about 8 years. It was mostly B2B. There was some elements, I would say, to B2C, which I think is good to get that foundation out of the way. In terms of like doing email marketing or email automation and so forth. From there, I just kept on, going to the next level, basically just managing larger e-commerce stores or more e-commerce properties, or having more people report to me. Ended up going into the medical distribution field for a while, building a lot of functionality around a medical distributor's website. Then found myself on the other side of the fence, as I say, working for a manufacturer that had global products and consumable products and capital equipment as well that they sold. Ended up coming back to my home state of Connecticut, working for a distributor yet again. And now I'm back on the other side of the fence, working for a manufacturer of medical devices.
Can you tell us a little bit about this? Sorry, we went at the same time. I think we probably have a million questions, but can you tell us, you said you kind of went up levels. What was like kind of the largest scale, or I know maybe you can't get too specific, but are we talking hundreds of millions or even billions online, or what would
you say? Hundreds. I would say it's probably like in the hundreds of millions.
Okay.
It's interesting question that you ask, because I've never worked for a purely 100% e-commerce company.
Very few B2B e-commerce businesses are, right?
It's 100%, or over on the B2C side, of course.
I've
always had to, you know, have some kind of balance with the traditional sales channel at the company that I've been at. And typically that's, you know, your field sales or your inside sales folks, trying to convince them that I was there to take their place.
We can get into that. But what would you say is the typical mix? So if they're doing hundreds of millions, that's still only 10% or 20%?
It can range from 10 to 30%.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, when I was just going to make an observation, your current company, Boston Scientific, has actually been a client of mine twice, and back when they were primarily a catalog business, you know. So, so I was working on like list optimization for them and data cleansing,
right?
It goes back quite a while, early 2000s, really. But it was a really significant business, but they wanted to figure out what to do online. And I'm not sure exactly when that happened. So I was going to ask you, do you know when those decisions were made and kind of how?
I don't, unfortunately. Internally? Yeah, okay. It's a great question. I happen not to know, because I'm recent hiree at the company.
My take on it, and the reason I was bringing it up, is that like a lot of other folks in B2B, they waited a while, for whatever reason. They were doing quite well, it's not as if they weren't making money, but whereas a lot of B2C players leapt, in that dot-com boom and right after, B2B didn't. It took a while longer for a lot of folks in that space.
I can't so speak for my current employer, but I would agree with what you said, that a lot of B2B companies some are behind the curve in their digital transformation. Some are a little bit more aggressive. Often what I experience is that when they looked at the B2B e-commerce channel, they thought of it more of how can we get incremental sales. So the focus was really on incremental sales rather than the other benefits that e-commerce or digital marketing can bring to the org.
So I have so many questions because you have so much experience in this on the merchant side, but what do you think is the difference between the companies doing 10 to 30%? It's a pretty big delta, right? Do you think that they're more mature and the 30% is because they're better at it, or the products they're selling, or the culture? What do you think is like the difference? I have a follow-up to that, but let's start there.
There's a lot of, I would say there are a lot of changes. A couple, I would say off the top of my head, by the way, I'm not a native English speaker, and I've got a couple languages floating around.
You're doing better than I am.
Sometimes I'm wondering what language I'm supposed to be talking in. When you start getting into larger organizations, they tend to have a lot more departments and a lot more stakeholders that are involved in the decision-making. When you're at a smaller organization, you're wearing just so many hats that you can tend to make decisions much more rapidly. But with larger, as you get into larger and larger companies, you really need to spend a lot of time beating that message, into folks until you finally get them on board with what you're planning. I think that's one of the differences I noticed. Probably the second area is around technology, because the larger companies, they're either been around for a long time, and so they have very old legacy systems, or they've purchased a lot of smaller companies along the way. And so they tend to have multiple backend systems that somehow need to talk to each other. Some of them are working towards kind of integrating them all together, or, replatforming. Whereas the smaller companies tend to not have that baggage so much. Product-wise, some smaller companies could have hundreds of thousands of SKUs, and then some larger companies could have fewer SKUs. So I don't really tend to see it as product. The process of how they acquire the products could be a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm more thinking it might be workflow. Some might be harder to sell online just for whatever reason.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I've never seen that as a huge point to consider on how I approach selling products from a smaller company to a larger company.
Yeah. So you think it's partly just the obstacles. So in a way, you're saying you think that the smaller companies have an advantage of potentially being able to move faster and bring that number higher. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're more nimble, they're more agile. With business, your customers may say, I need this today. But if you take so many months to deliver that, by the time you deliver it, it might not be exactly what the customer told you a few months ago. So the more agile you can be, the faster you can respond to the customer's needs, the better business outcomes you're going to have.
So why do you think the numbers are so low? I mean, 10 to 30%, and a lot of companies, it's much less than 10. What do you think is preventing it from being a lot higher, you know?
For B2B, right? So I would say there might be a couple things. One, typically the C-suite at most companies, they will tend to be filled with managers that work their way up through the sales org, the traditional sales channel. And so they haven't always bought into the whole digital experience. You know, they really feel that human factor is more important than going through a digital channel. So I think that's one. But that's, you know, that's slowly changing, because I do encounter a lot of traditional managers from that area where they're gung-ho for e-commerce. So I'm not saying it's all of them, but that's often the case, I think. The other area is that B2B products tend to be a little bit more complicated than your B2C product. Like, to sell a t-shirt online, you know, the pictures are what's most important for it. But if you're selling like capital equipment, of course you can put pictures, you could put products, pictures and product information, and you could put some configurators on your site to help the customer kind of go through a guided selling process to kind of qualify themselves to figure out what they need. But very often they actually do need an expertise to be able to explain to them exactly what they need. So I would say that might be an impediment. And then in terms of how they sell, a lot of these larger companies, they will either use a field sales, or more often than not, distributors. And so if you are thinking about doing e-commerce, then you have to figure out, where does your distributor network fit in all of that? So do you bring them along with you, or do you start to slowly reduce your need for distributors? So that comes into play.
I mean, one of the things I would bring up too, that's a consideration, is that companies that survey their customers and have customer panels or client panels often move faster, in this regard, right? They're moving from that 10%
voice of the customer.
Yeah, it's all voice of the customer. So really, in a sense, why do you think there are companies that don't listen to their customers as much as they should? You know, that's sort of the reason here, because there are companies at 10%, and they could be there for a whole bunch of reasons. But it's also very clear that customers and clients are demanding, you know, certain things happen. Why aren't they happening?
You know, I don't think you'll ever interview a company that says, we don't listen to our customers. Everyone says they listen to their customers.
They say that.
That's the key. They say that. But sometimes at larger organizations, what happens is they have those assumptions that they picked up years ago, and they carry those assumptions forward. And they'll say that, oh, our customers, they want to speak to our salespeople, or our customers want to send us faxes. Voice of the customer means constantly getting the voice of the customer and not having those assumptions from years ago, or laying your own kind of thoughts on what the customers really need.
Do you think sometimes?
I think you're really right.
Do you think sometimes they're too far removed too? Right, some of these larger organizations,
I don't think that's it, because they do have field sales, and so the field sales are really close to the customer. So I don't think that's it. And I do have field sales folks that will tell me, like, our customers are saying that compared to our competitors, we're very difficult to do business with. You know, what can we do to improve that? So Yeah, I don't think it's that.
I think we're not asking. They're not asking the right questions. So that makes me think like
that's a great one right there.
They don't know what to ask, so they think that they know because they're asking the same questions they asked 10 years ago.
Yeah,
but what they should be asking is like, if we built you this, or if we make it so you could order easily online, would you use that? And like, the answer might be yes. And they're just not asking those questions, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like going back to the original concept of sales, like features, advantages, and benefits. If you say to the customer, like, do you want this feature? And that doesn't translate to a benefit for them. You know, what's the advantage? If you say to them, would you like to reduce your returns, or would you like to be able to get your products faster, or would you like to be able to know exactly where your products are after we send them to you? Answers will be yes, usually, to those. But if you say, you do you want e-commerce?
One place to see everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, there's a two-pronged approach that I've seen working, you know, recently. It's kind of interesting. It's essentially where, you know, you're working very closely with the sales team, you know, however that sales team is configured. You're working very closely with them, trying to do things for them to make sales easier, right? And when you're positioning it in that particular way, they're like, well, it would be easier if I could do things through my phone when I'm with a client, when I do X, right? And so that usually is, you know, one whole set of things that works. And the second thing is, I found that when you ask B2B clients what their favorite B2C experiences are, they often say, well, I wish I could do that here, but that's what B2C does, right? It's fascinating how the conversations move then, because, you know, you're giving something to sales and you're replicating experiences that people that are positive in the B2C world.
And it can I think a lot of people, the reason they're not asking the questions is because they don't even know it's possible or it's in the realm of possibility. They maybe think it's too advanced for them because they don't have like Amazon budget. But like you said, I mean, we spoke offline before the podcast with tools like, you know, Shopify, BigCommerce, Magento, you have iMap integration platforms. A lot of this technology is, you know, it's not necessarily cheap, but it's reasonably affordable, I think.
Absolutely.
For most organizations, or at least there's a stepping stone path for most people to start to move in this direction.
To me, it's a revolution. It's like the revolution of desktop publishing. You know, when Apple started pushing desktop publishing, it gave the power into the hands of people to be able to, you know, do things that only the very few could do in the past. Timothy, I really like that first point that you said about working with the customer there, and that's really about sales enablement. And that's what I find at larger companies that smaller companies tend not to have. So they'll have an entire sales enablement team, or and sometimes that team could only be one person, but it could be around the country. And so what happens is, when you go to a new customer and the salesperson is talking about, okay, the reason why you should do business with us is because I'm going to get you this type of discount. Our products are great. We'll get you the products on time. But you really need to have someone from your e-commerce channel to be able to talk about the advantages of doing business with the company as well, the value add. And also having those sales enablement people go to your current customers to say, okay, what are your pain points? Okay, well, we can help you with these pain points. We can help you set up an inventory management system, or we could set up punch out for you, or some kind of admin order approval system. So that's really the key to winning, I think, at e-commerce.
So
sales enablement folks.
So, Carlos, I just got to pause and call out one thing you mentioned. You mentioned desktop publishing, and Isaiah knows this, our listeners know this, but my first business was a desktop publishing company. You know, it was called Top Drawer Publications, and it was a revolution because, you know, I took out a loan to buy a laser printer and to buy, you know, it was like $5,000, you know, back in the 80s. And then, you know, the same for an Apple computer, and then all the latest software, PageMaker and whatever in the day.
PageMaker.
And it was a revolution because everyone had to go to the printer to to get, you know, like a resume, which was ridiculous. So, you know, it's a perfect model for what you're saying here. It's just a leap that people are taking.
It makes me think, though, back to some of the original points you're making about like the board, where it's like, if you ask people what they wanted, they'd say like, I want a faster horse, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, instead of the car, like he invented the car, and that's why he's like, you know, you have to. And I feel like that's what's happening in B2B commerce. They're like, well, we talk to our customers, they just want like a better fax machine or a better customer service on the call. Or it's like, but really a lot of this stuff could be just so much more efficient and automated through the website, you know, through
Google. Yeah. You know, the other topic I think about is, when we think about voice of the customer, we think about customer experience. And there are companies that talk a lot about customer experience. We need to improve our customer experience. But it's often difficult to kind of quantify, okay, if we spend this amount of money on improving our customer experience, what does that translate? Is that going to translate into sales? Does that translate into this or that? So companies have a hard time figuring out. They know that they need to improve the customer experience because maybe their NPS scores are saying so, or whatever way they measure themselves. But
yeah,
they have a hard time justifying spend on customer experience.
It's somewhat subjective, right? That's what makes it challenging. But that's why I think it's so important that people do start to invest in e-commerce and start to build on it, because eventually you can make way more data-driven decisions. So once you get to 10%, you know, let's say you get to 10%, because a lot of people are at zero or close to zero, right? Mm-hmm. If you can get to 10%, now you can say, all right, customers buy this. Let's make the experience better around those products, or let's make the recommendations engine better, or people call in for tracking information. Let's make it so they can find the tracking information more easily. Like, that's the thing about e-commerce, is that you can actually start to make more data-driven decisions instead of intuition, you know, customer experience decisions based on the opinions of your sales reps.
Right.
The amount of data you can start to develop with e-commerce is just insane, right? I mean, that's a lot of what we're getting more into, just because we're realizing how little people are doing with their data, you know?
Yeah, that's totally spot on.
Because otherwise, if you don't do it, what do you have? You just have sales reps and the data of the ERP, which is generally pretty limited data, right? Because you don't actually have any user experience data. You don't know how the customer got to the website, how they use it. There's just so much more information when they use a website versus just like,
sure, you know what they're looking at or what will be, you know, it's interesting. Think back into COVID, just as like COVID started getting into the news, we could completely see the climb in our internal search and our inbound traffic around PPE. Now, we weren't, this is not my present company, this is a past company I worked for, but, you know, that wasn't our main business, right? And so it was kind of our somewhat of a side, not side business, but not our core category business.
Yeah.
We could see that increase, and we knew it was going to be a wave of demand that was coming in. So if you can have that intelligence, then you can go to your procurement department and say, hey, we got to get ahead of this and bring this product in, because that's where the demand is going to be in the next couple of months.
Well, I think it's a better way to say is, if you don't increase e-commerce, how are you going to make good decisions? Right?
Yeah. Right.
Like, is it just looking at your ERP data, which is just not really competitive, honestly, and probably not that great, or talking to your sales reps? Like, is that really a good long-term strategy to grow the business? You know, like, that's, to me, that's just very, very, competitive, you know?
Yeah. What I think about a lot is, in my past, the metrics that I was asked to deliver. And a lot of times it was either adoption of e-commerce, you know, increase the adoption of e-commerce, or use e-commerce as a customer acquisition channel, because we want to be able to sell to those customers after they place their first order online, offline. I don't ask me why. But a lot of times it was about incremental sales. Like they viewed e-commerce as just, you know, kind of, the cherry on top, you know, the, you know, not
a little bit of new revenue. Like, you know, that's
they, yeah, that's it. Right.
We'll capture the smaller orders online and then
there you go. Right.
Well, the joke used to be that you'd say, do you want fries with that? That's how B2B treated e-commerce.
Yeah,
exactly. That was the joke. Yeah.
But now there's, to me, a fundamental shift. And that is this. Not so much how the question isn't how much will we gain through e-commerce? It's how much, like, won't you lose? Because e-commerce is an expectation of customers now. Being able to have a very frictionless experience, being able to do business the way the customer wants to do business with you. And the generations that are coming up, they're demanding digital, right? There's a lot of surveys around younger folks saying, I don't want to talk to a salesperson. Now, if that's what they're saying, well, when they start doing those purchases, when they have that, the wallets behind them at the companies, that's gonna hurt your bottom line. So it's not, the question isn't these days, you know, well, how much can we add with e-commerce? And you will add, trust me, you will. But you're also protecting your business by having e-commerce there.
Well, you know, and it, as we've pointed out in this podcast before, it's actually no longer just about the younger customers. It really is customers across the board, because customers who are 55 have been around for the entirety of the history of the
internet. They might have been an eBay customer in 2000,
and they have expectations actually too. Those
folks, they buy things for themselves during the day, right?
But everyone,
I also wonder how much business they're losing and they don't know that they're losing it, right? Because I mean, I would bet you that a lot of B2C orders are actually B2B. So a lot of orders that go through Amazon or Costco or whatever it is, there may be smaller orders, right? But they're just secondaries, or even we do this sometimes. We just order stuff that we don't, you know, it's not big enough where we want. Like, there's just a lot of stuff that we don't want. We don't need to go speak to a sales rep, and we'll just buy little things. But we're a business, right? And so
I think
when you're thinking about buyers, I mean, my wife runs a small Airbnb business, that I help her with, and all she does is buy online. Like, everything she does is buy online, and not everything is like a business account. I mean, she's getting better at setting some of those up, but a lot of it's going to come through as a consumer order, Right. It is a business. And so I think a lot of demand is lost, especially in like the small business, because they're just doing what's convenient for them, and they don't have time to like build a relationship and talk to a sales rep for a $500 order.
So I have a question based on something you mentioned earlier, talking about like B2B and like expertise. You use that word when we're talking about like salespeople versus e-commerce and whatever, and looking for expertise. Where do you think things like video and social media fit into B2B e-commerce? And, obviously they're critical to B2C. And I think they're also critical, but maybe not as used, or maybe they're misused in B2B. What do you think about stuff like that?
Yeah, I think they have their place for sure. I would not ignore them. You definitely want to have measurement around them to see how effective they are for your particular business. In the industries that I've been in, I wouldn't say so much that the social media is driving the customers to come to my site to be able to add something to the car and check out. It's more of serving a purpose of building your brand, or keeping your company top of mind, because if you take LinkedIn, B2B people are on there all the time, so that's pretty effective. I don't know if some of the other social media networks out there are as effective for B2B in the space that I'm in. Videos are important. Whether they're on a social media network, or you're hosting them on your site for product information, because videos can be a wonderful way to explain complex products. I would say that they should be very well integrated into the product detail pages. But yeah, I think it's not something to ignore, but I'm not quite sure it drives revenue.
What about Twitter for sales or service? Like Twitter for sales or service for B2B?
I really don't think much about Twitter for B2B, but again, it depends on the industry that you're in and where your customers may be. Yeah.
What about SMS though? I could see that, like text alerts, text.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you guys done much with text and SMS or?
Surprisingly, no. Just because of various compliances or privacy rules that I sometimes face. opting in and whatnot. But like I said, if you're, let's say, a distributor of electrical equipment, probably electricians or factory managers and so forth, they're going to be on these various social media network sites. So if you can segment them and target them, absolutely it could be a good way to bring in business.
Top of the funnel, especially, brand awareness.
Yeah.
Brand building. What about, we haven't got too much into like the nuts and bolts of what you've done, right? And I'm curious, like, what advice or maybe what stories and lessons you've learned of, like, coming into an organization, maybe they're not fully bought in or they're partially bought in, and you have, like you said, some salespeople that don't believe as much as others.
Right.
How do you overcome these things? And are they more technical challenges, more people challenges? I mean, it's a mix of everything, right? But like,
it's a mix of everything, but more often than not, it's change management.
Okay.
And you find yourself being an influencer. So usually the technology is not the hard part, because you should have good technology partners within your company, or you can hire Isaiah and he'll take care of the technology for you.
I think it's also that what we find is that they're not willing to change to make e-commerce. So on our side, what we find often is they're not willing to change to make e-commerce easier. And then they're upset when it turns out it's expensive to build those things, right? It's like, hey, you want to build it the way that you do it now with your weird processes and your legacy ERP. It's like, we can do that.
Yeah.
Maybe like three times.
Gotcha.
More if you like change one little process and then simplified pricing. You know what I mean? Like
I get you. So
I think that change management.
I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? So yeah,
what happens with e-commerce is that, I think we were talking about this before the show, is that it exposes a lot of the bad processes that you have at your company or the bad governance. And so a great example is like PIM. Companies that don't have PIMs, well, when they go to implement a PIM, they start realizing, like, we've got junk data in our ERP. There's no governance.
The problem is the PIM isn't going to solve that. And that's what I say. I'm like,
that's the PIM point.
But are you going to even be able to use it, because you have no way of like doing a good job of the product data? Like, if you can't make your product data good in Excel, you can't make it good in a PIM. You know what I mean? Right. Like,
so, yeah. So that's the point. Like, it exposes these skeletons in your closet, things that you need to fix up in order to put into a digital format. Yeah. So that's where I think there's pain involved. Going back to your original question, like when you go into a company, what do you got to do? I think if it's a B2B company, you need to really connect with the salespeople, because I think they're either going to break your success or not. If you try to build e-commerce in a glass silo, it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
You really need to work with the salespeople.
That'll be like the first thing you would do, right? Like,
that's it.
We'll meet with the sales executive.
Yeah, I'm not going to come in and say, do this, do that, get rid of that. Basically, I'm going to meet with the salespeople. I'm going to go to the customer's location. And that's a that's something that e-commerce people often forget to do, because we're kind of like digital guys, right? So, and girls. And so
yeah,
like,
do it on a computer. Behind, yeah, we can do everything remote. Yeah,
we do everything remote. And that's wrong. You know, you actually need to go out into the field and meet with your customers, see how they do their business and see what their pain points are.
Did you ever find something interesting? You're like, oh, now I need to build this feature. I never even thought about from doing that, or?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or, I was building a feature and I thought it's exactly what they wanted, because that's what my voice of customer manager said is what they needed. But when, you know, when I tested it against a small group of customers, it wasn't what they wanted. Exactly. So I had to quickly, go back and rework it. So
I definitely like cutting out the middleman a little bit. It's going to be, I mean, the more people in between the person to get the information, the less likely it is to be accurate. You know what I mean?
So all right. So going back to your question. So we start with the sales folks, right? Getting them on board. I think the next place you go is to logistics. All the people
involved. I always say e-commerce is like 50% logistics. Like,
yeah, right.
I'm like, I want to do shipping. We don't have any weights and dims or any. Yeah. It's like, you can't tell them the shipping price until after the order, and then you weigh it. Like, they have to weigh the product before they give them.
You can make the most beautiful site in the world and the slickest checkout, but if you can't get that product to the customer when you say you're going to get it, especially in a B2B world, because they're expecting that product to arrive at a certain time.
Tell them shipping prices, right? Like,
we can't give you taxes or shipping until after you place your order or something.
Yeah, then that's a huge barrier, in my opinion.
So like, again,
surprise shipping fee, you know?
It goes back to that exposing of those skeletons, you know? Like, when you start digging around a logistics department, you'll soon find out, like, oh, we're not able to do that. So it really limits what you can do through e-commerce.
Yeah, I found something like,
or pushes them to implement something.
You can't even do small parcel, right? Like, they can only do like large truckloads. And then it's like, well, what if someone wants $1,000 order? Can't do that. It's like,
yeah. So I would go there next. You know?
Yeah.
But you might want to, let's go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. You continue. I'll jump in.
I was going to say, maybe my next stop down the C-suite is to finance.
Real quick, the logistics people, would that usually live on the COO or the operations ops team somewhere?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So a COO type department kind of thing.
Right, ops, yeah. Yeah, so I was going to say that probably the next person I would talk to is
CFO.
is the finance people. I want to make sure that when an order is placed, whether it's in the e-commerce channel or through the traditional channel, whoever owns that account, i.e. the salesperson, will get compensated for it. Because what I don't want to have is a situation where it's e-commerce versus traditional sales, because
The episode before this was with Justin King, and one of the key points he made is that he thinks companies, if they want to really grow, is they should actually compensate sales reps more for bringing on sales to the e-com and less offline. And then you'll see a very rapid shift, because all of a sudden sales reps are like, oh shit. He's like, they'll game the system, but that's okay, because you're forcing the company to adapt to e-commerce much more quickly than otherwise. So
yeah, you could do that way, or base it on margin. So if e-commerce gives a better margin, like it's a lower cost to do business channel, then they should be compensated.
Getting higher commission, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a classic trick in a way. Like, as a consultant, I've gone in and I'll say, well, tell me the margins, you know, for the distributors versus this. And then I wait, you know, and then they present it. It's like, oh, isn't it interesting that you're getting a better margin over here, but you're not investing as much over here? You know, and it's fascinating how quickly things will change.
So before you, I mean, I know there's more stops, I'm guessing, but before you even go on, what are the pitfalls or things that, you know, what resistance did you get in this? Because I could imagine, and the reason I'm asking this, I see so many new e-com people. I mean, I'm not going to name the company. I can tell you multiple times clients where they've gotten fired. And all of a sudden we go, hey, this guy, we get an email. This guy no longer works here because he was mostly set up to fail, but probably just not capable of going and dealing with all these different C-suite conversations.
Yeah, it's tough. It's difficult.
And also the companies aren't as mature. And then they just say, why is the project taking so long? Or, you know, and they just fire him. Right. And so help these people who hopefully listen to this podcast, you know, in these roles, not get fired because they are like,
you really need a champion at that C-suite. And if you don't have that champion, then you it's not going to go well for you. You'll probably be hitting your head against the wall for a couple of years. You'll be, I think that's the key point right there is having someone at the level of all the decision makers at the company really being that champion who has your back, who understands, who sets the expectation like, okay, these are the KPIs that we're going to judge you against, and they're going to be fair KPIs, and they're going to make sense, those KPIs, not like, okay, your main KPI is going to be your conversion rate. That's it.
So
that's important.
What resistance is you in those departments? So sales, CFO, COO?
Yeah. Usually the area where I see the most resistance is around the complexity of products. So it kind of goes back to, I think you're saying like e-commerce is great for the laundry list, the inexpensive things, the consumables, let's sell all of that on e-commerce. Stuff. Right. Yeah. But it's really not meant for the complicated capital equipment. That's typically where I see the most resistance at the segment that I'm in, getting buy-in to have those type of products online. Especially there's a resistance of putting pricing online, right? So you'll go to some B2B companies where they'll say, you know, we don't want to have any pricing online. We can't show pricing online. So make it so that the customer needs to be logged in order to see pricing. Well, that's at least better than nothing because at least they will see pricing when they're online. But you'd be surprised. You're not surprised because you're actually going to these companies and seeing the resistance of putting pricing online.
Yeah. And why do you think that they should? Because, the other problem is they're going to say, well, we don't want to put list price because that's not the real price or what. How do you overcome that, right? Or what's the value for them to do it, you know?
Yeah, I had those arguments in the past. First of all, putting some type of price in front of the customers who are not logged in. In other words, they're not registered. I think that's important for SEO purposes. I believe like Google Merchant or what is it?
Yeah, you wouldn't even be able to put your products on Google Merchant Center.
Right? Yeah, exactly that, right. But
don't even get me started on marketing, but I think we should come back to that. Marketing is like...
Have a couple more episodes to go.
We need to have you come back and maybe, you know, if you can make the event, maybe we just talk about marketing because that could be like a two-hour episode.
It could be.
Well, that's what I studied, marketing. What were you saying about the pricing? Yeah, so it sets some kind of expectation, but the key is how you message it. Because if you just put a list price, they're probably going to see another price that's lower, right? So you need to message like, you know, sign in for your contract pricing.
Yeah, or tiered pricing.
Yeah, have some tiered discounts. That's awesome. I love that. But once they've logged in, they should be able to connect to their contracted pricing, whatever that is in the ERP. And by the way, that's really critical and that's a deal breaker. If those contracted customers are not seeing the exact price your e-commerce site that they should be getting through their sales.
That's a specific technical challenge that I find though, because sometimes extracting the price out of the ERP can be challenging.
It's hard, right? Because there could be rules in that ERP or a pricing engine that modifies the pricing.
Yeah.
So you should get your pricing from you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we did this. We had to spend a lot of time with a partner building this product for Infor SX, so we can real time extract the pricing out of Infor SX.
Yeah, yeah.
To do that is not easy, right? I spent a lot of engineering manpower to build that for just specific ERP.
I believe it.
Yeah, one thing I would add to this too is, you know, we've talked here and before about tier pricing, and I think that there is really a move in B2B to, you know, to having, you know, just formulaic pricing that's fair, because I think one of the other things that B2B consumers have brought up, you know, clients have brought up, is that it's really not fair to have, you know, secret pricing all over the place. It's because you're my pal and you're this and you're that. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people hate, you know, quote unquote, you know, certain relationships that they've had, or distributors or salespeople, because they feel like there's some sort of velvet rope that they have to get past. If you're democratizing the process through, you know, all of the things that we're talking about here, they know they're going to have to pay a lot of money. And a clear example is a lighting company that I worked with, where they did put forms online for people to basically configure very large orders for facilities or for municipalities or whatever. And then they would see, it's like, okay, if I'm ordering 6,000 of this light bulb, which is a completely legitimate number for a building, right? Then it's going to be this pricing. And that they were assured that was the pricing across the board for anyone ordering that quantity. They're like, okay, great. Now I know what I'm working with. Right.
What I find is that a lot of people are just so scared that if you do this, even with the logged in pricing or make it more accessible, that people are going to steal the pricing, or competitors are going to get access.
I love that excuse.
Yeah, it's an excuse. It's not a reason. It's an excuse, not a reason. An
excuse we hear a lot in certain.
Yeah. Well, think about it. Like, when I hear that excuse, the customer has probably shopped. So the customer already knows.
Of course.
Kind of a stupid excuse, right? Because you're like, really think they're not going to be able to find pricing elsewhere? Like, you know, it seems like a pretty poor way of, you know.
And
well, their competitors are going to somehow get access to it, but it's like,
but you should not just be competing on pricing alone, though. No. You know, so don't be hung up on that. You know, there should be other factors that go into your e-commerce site that are convincing people to buy from you beyond that price.
There have to be unique products, proprietary services, you know, different things that you're doing.
Can you fulfill the product?
The heart of the whole value proposition. It can't just be like, it's the price of this versus this.
Otherwise, then you're basically a business to consumer, you know, right? Then you're basically Walmart, right? Like at that point, you know?
Totally. It reminds me of the days back when I was in retail. There would be this store down the road for me, and they would beat us up on price all the time. And customer would say, I could get it cheaper down the road. And my first question is, do they have it in stock? Well, no, I mean, they'd be able to get it in 2 months from now. Like, I have it in stock right now. So there's a reason why that price is so low.
Yeah, because they're saying it's low in the future. It's like, which is not a guarantee, by the way, right? Like,
right.
So, yeah, no, that's really funny. We can get it cheaper, maybe, in the future.
Now,
inflation will come down in 2 years, probably, right? Like, that is probably going to happen. But you don't know 100% for sure, you know? I would try to make a bet. I bet that, but, you know. I don't know.
So we were talking about who we should be meeting when we join a B2B e-commerce company. So I think probably the last person by the way, this is no in particular order maybe, but one important person I'm going to want to meet is whoever they're. It could be a creative director, it could be a marketing person, basically whoever's in charge of user experience. In some smaller companies, there isn't anyone. And I think that is a really key area where I think I see distinction between companies that are really firing on all cylinders and companies that are kind of just like treading water. Having someone in that company or hiring someone like Isaiah and crew, by the way, I don't I don't get commission for any mentions of I'll give you some business as well, some leads. What I was going to say is, like, or hire someone who knows user experience.
Sure.
Because it is an art. And I've seen a lot of companies where someone who was doing graphic design last year, someone who's doing web design, it's a different skill. UI, UX is a certain skill that not everyone has.
E-commerce UI, UX.
UX
is even its own nuance.
Right.
Actually, one of the biggest problems we see in design, I encounter, I have a customer whose site is live. I'm not going to name them. They're unhappy. I'm going to try to meet them in person because they're local. But they can't really tell me why they're unhappy with the design. Mm-hmm. And they and I asked my creative director, he's like, they just didn't give us a fair shot. And they had their internal graphic designers, not a UX expert, design it, and it came out much worse than if we had done it. And it's harder to translate their work to the developers because people don't understand it's not just design, it's actually technical too.
Sure. It's that customer journey understanding what is that next step, that in the intuitive step that the customer needs to take. So when you're selling to someone in B2B, you're selling to someone who's buying something because that's their job or that's their company, right? It's not like you're selling a t-shirt. They're buying it because it looks good, right? So, you know, their job, let's say, if they're typically a purchasing agent at the company, right? That's all they do all day. They just go to these sites or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're buying products. Mm-hmm. You have to make it as easy as possible for them. And they will gravitate towards the sites that make it as easy as possible for them to get their job done. They want to go home by 5 o'clock to see their kids. Your site is slow.
It doesn't need to be like this flashy brand experience, right? And that's where another thing that I've seen go wrong is that companies will spend way too much time and effort on this like flashy brand experience. Not that there's not importance to some of that.
Yeah,
there's a level of that that's not the same as B2C. Right. Like you said, you're not convincing someone to buy my t-shirt versus the 100 other variations of t-shirts that I could buy.
Yeah.
You're convincing them, or it's their job. Actually, this all goes back to Justin King's. Like they're buying because it's their job and they need this their job.
I have a need.
Yeah.
Do you have that product that fills that need? Yes or no? You know, a great example of this is when you're buying through a B2C site, you're placing a couple orders a week, right? But when you're selling, So if you're in the B2B world and you're displaying, let's say you have like a dashboard, right? The customer's logged in and they can see their orders, and like the way you display their orders. A B2B customer might be placing tons of orders in a week. And so how do you display that information, all those orders, right? So if you display it the wrong way, it's just not going to work. And so going back to your comment, you need UI, UX, e-commerce skill set.
How to think about the category, the attributes, user journey, the cart, the checkout. Yeah.
Right.
Sure. And yeah. But also the other thing that we find is that people don't realize that there's a cost to all this. So they have a budget, right? Let's say their budget is $200,000. And we know how to design for that budget with what platform. If you just get some graphic designer, they have no idea what they're designing is in budget, you know, or the brand guys. We see this all the time. I can't tell you how many third-party brand firms I've worked with that the client likes the branding and they're artsy and the look and feel. They pay them a bunch of money, and then they don't have enough money to actually build it, or it goes over budget because it wasn't aligned with technical.
Right.
Or it doesn't even convert that well, and they end up going back towards a more traditional design. So they end up reverting back some of the brand fancy things, because they don't convert well from like an e-commerce experience. Like there's a reason.
So what do you say when that customer says to you, "Hey, Isaiah, can you put 12 sliders on this hero?"
I always try and talk people out of sliders, right? I mean, that's been proven over and over. Sliders are generally not effective for the most part.
I mean, a web designer would probably say, "Okay, I'll do that."
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, sliders are generally not usually that effective, just because it's, well, one, most people don't wait around for the next slide. And two, you're just adding overhead to the site that doesn't really have value. And yeah, it just makes it slower. But yeah, I mean, yeah, couldn't agree with you more. I think the problem that I think in B2B especially is that this is such a different world. In B2C, it's like, they might be on their third Shopify site, right? Or the third design, you know, they're more likely to be on like that path forward because they're constantly looking at the metrics and it's driving immediate revenue and top line revenue to the business. Whereas there's usually just no one in the B2B organization that's really, you know, qualified to do this because, you know, unless they get someone like you, which is pretty rare, you know, maybe they had a B2C background or maybe they had, you know, graphic design background, but they're really not B2B e-commerce design experts, right? And so I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
It's just a huge gap.
It's true. And one bit of advice I'd also share is when you're doing the enhancements or you're doing the adding of the functionality, you do it in a real agile, continuous improvement method. Because again, those people, they're buying, that's their job. The customers, you know, purchase a agent. Every day they got to go to your site. They got to click the red button. They got to do this. They got to do that. It's muscle memory that they're using. And then when you suddenly do this radical design, like every month, that screws up their
muscle memory. You don't know what even works, right? You don't. And I think that's another mistake is if you change too much at once.
That's what I'm saying.
Change has actually helped the customer.
What moved the needle, right?
Yeah. Well, but I think that agile is another concept that B2B really struggles with, from my experience.
They like waterfall. You're right.
They do not get agile, from my experience. But yeah.
Ahead. What I was gonna add to that, Carlos, is that the one thing I've seen recently too is that a lot of B2B e-commerce businesses are learning from, you know, like B2B SaaS, which is kind of interesting. So e-commerce is learning from SaaS, where, you know, in SaaS, in a sense, you have these dashboards that are highly configurable. You know, you can look at things in all sorts of different ways. And if you're adding that kind of functionality or that kind of viewpoint to clients on the client portal portion, let's say, of a B2B e-commerce site, they're thrilled, right? Because they're already familiar with that experience, you know, and whatever other tools that they might be using. And it gives them the flexibility they need to kind of chart things out, resort, regroup, you know, just whatever they need, get a CSV and download whatever they have to, right? It just makes perfect sense. And it's easy. That's the thing that's really weird too, is that people forget how easy that is because the tech already exists.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. By the way, we in our tour of the company, did we miss the procurement department? Because, and of course, it depends on where, what company you're talking about, but the procurement department is typically where I'm finding they're holding on to the product information. They're bringing in the products and they're putting those into the ERP. Mm-hmm. So that conversations are really important. And I've been on the manufacturer side where I was surprised that the product information is just so poor. I mean, we're actually building the products, not present company, past companies, but we don't. Like, how do we even market our own products if we don't have, you know?
Yeah, if the information is that bad, how do you?
Yeah.
We need to talk about marketing because, like I said, I think marketing is like a whole episode not something we've spent as much time as I'd like in the 90 episodes that we have so far.
And I'm a marketer too.
I'm a marketer too. Yeah. We're all marketers. Yeah. But it's funny because, like, I've been in some jobs where I've been so focused on building the table stakes of the platform, integrating things behind the hood, you know, underneath the hood, you know, figuring things out. And you spend so much of that you realize, like, actually, I'm not doing any of the marketing side of e-commerce. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge missed opportunity.
Well, I think
there's got to be a balance there.
I think that it is two different jobs, right? I think that
it is
so much work to do on the operational, just like, I would call it more like, what's the word? You already used it. The adoption, like, just trying to get, like, let's say getting existing customers adopted. That is a lot of work, right? We're talking about the pricing integration, ERP, like all the things you mentioned, but that's not even necessarily marketing, right? Like getting existing customers adopted doesn't really have much to do with, or has some, right? There's overlap.
But it does. I mean, it can overlap. But it should work in unison.
But marketing, I'd say, is its own job. The other thing I see that I fail, I think, with B2B is they're not really usually that great at marketing because it's been so sales driven, right? It's been so account. They've been historically such account based marketers, going door to door or calling, cold calling. You know, that's how they built their business. That they've never
really
great marketing.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's a really great point because if a customer is already on a contract price, right? And typically, like in B2C world, you can send out e-blasts all day long. Here's some promos. Here's a discount. Yeah. Buy two, get three. You know, spend over $200, get discount. There's 1,000 different promotions that we're going to be able to talk to about in our future marketing-centric e-commerce podcast. Right? but when you get a B2B, like you can't touch the pricing. So
you can't do. Yeah, you can't like blast promos once a week, right?
No,
like, yeah, because their margin, especially if you're a distributor, you don't have 30% margin to give away or 20, you know what I mean? Like your margin might only be 20%, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, especially in the distributor space, it's like very hard. I mean, I think in the marketing, it's a different world. I think there's actually a ton of opportunity in Google Shopping, to your point. I think if I was a B2B company, I've done this. I've gotten insane results on Google Shopping and Facebook ads, and actually much higher than B2C because the competition's so low.
All right. That's a great point.
Tool XYZ.
Yeah.
I get, you know, if I have 100,000 SKUs on Google Shopping, I might only have a handful of legitimate competitors that are maybe not even legit companies. They might be some shady ass, you know, crappy companies that you're competing against because most of the other legit companies are too scared to put their stuff on Google Shopping.
Right.
You know? So I've actually seen higher ROI on Google Shopping with B2B than I have in B2C, actually.
Do your customers do a lot of business like through like local Google advertisements and, you know, local sales?
For pickup, the businesses that I've worked
with,
it's pickup. Okay. Absolutely.
Not as much. We've definitely focused more on we might do more like local targeted ads, but we've primarily focused on Google search, Bing search, Facebook, Instagram. Okay. We've actually had some insane results on Facebook ads for B2B. Because you can target job descriptions, personas that get, you know, obviously it's going to depend. If you're selling a $100,000 piece of equipment, it's probably not. But, you know, auto parts, for instance, could be really successful on Facebook. You know?
Is that right?
Oh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I always imagine auto parts is an extremely competitive market.
Well, it is. But, you know, if you have a good offering.
No, I've worked in that space, too. And I've seen the same thing Isaiah has. It's really pretty remarkable. Also, and I say this over and over again, and people should listen, things like TikTok actually do work for B2B. The reason is you're educating people and entertaining people, and everyone has two sides. You know, they're a consumer and they're doing their B2B work. If they're out on TikTok and they happen to see a company that they're familiar with, then they circle back. They ended up doing other things. So a lot of attraction out of it. Yeah.
So it sounds like you guys are saying to me that I should branch out beyond MySpace then.
and Friendster.
Well, I guess I'm behind the curve here. You guys are teaching me something.
Yeah. I mean, you got to pick your battles too, right? I also recommend that, like, look, you probably don't have time to invest in all the channels.
Nobody does.
So, you know, we usually say, like, let's get Google search, Google Shopping. You know, Bing is actually surprising.
We have to do a ChatGPT episode.
That's a whole nother ball game. But really try and get like, you know, 4 or 5 core channels going really well. Or when I say 4 or 5, it's really Google and Meta. Like if you can get that down, then it's probably also going to be hard to do TikTok, right? It's like, you don't want to do all these channels bad, right? Like you need to start somewhere and, you know.
It's really just being first. You know, I think that's what a lot of the benefit is. A lot of businesses that are out there early are getting that early adopter advantage.
Well, you're going to get more organic traffic on TikTok because it's not less saturated. You, if you're the B2B guy, you might be the only B2B guy on TikTok in your space. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. That reminds me of like back in the day when all these social medias networks were first coming out, and there was a lot of push by my management to just like put posts out there about our products. Just it's product posts, and you're basically shoving.
Doesn't do anything. It's the worst on ads, but not organic. Yeah, right. People don't understand the big difference between organic and ads. Yeah.
Like we should probably come to a close shortly because I know that we both two of us have.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
clearly we need a marketing. It's very obvious we need to have a marketing episode.
Like, I think we do.
So we didn't get to the CMO, right? We talked about the COO, the CMO. Yes. Then we'll have the next episode of the marketing executive piece.
I think that's a good plan.
Great plan. It's been a huge pleasure. I've really enjoyed myself, and I really appreciate this opportunity. Come on board and speak to you and your listeners.
Carlos Camacho, can our listeners and viewers find you on LinkedIn or elsewhere?
They can find me on LinkedIn and elsewhere. They can also find me often at the B2B online e-commerce conference, which I'm an advisor of. And they're held in Chicago and also in Florida every year.
I'll definitely be there this year. So I will.
Oh, excellent.
Great. When's the next one?
It should be in May, I want to say. It's usually in the springtime in Chicago. Yeah, it's fantastic because they bring together distributors and manufacturers that are just solely focused on B2B e-commerce.
Is this Digital Commerce 360 doing that conference?
No, it's not. It's the other one. Yeah, it's a different one. It's the other one.
Got it. The other one. There's so many now.
Go to them all.
All right. This is great. Well, thank you so much, Isaiah. Any last words?
Thank you both. Yeah.
No, I mean, I really think there's just so much to talk about on the marketing side. And that's a whole
lot. Yeah, we scratched the surface. Yeah.
That, to your point, is so understood, misunderstood, right? It's just, but there's too much to talk about in this. So we'll get back to it and we'll have you back. I can't wait.
Yeah, and to trigger emails next time.
We could probably just spend the whole episode on just email, but
that's right. There you go. My favorite topic.
Thanks, guys.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Take care. Cheers. Bye.